coming tonight, even though I know there is extraordinary competition in town. So obviously, those of you who have torn yourselves away to come here are special souls. So I appreciate very much your determination and your sincerity in the face of extraordinary temptation. But Krishna is also tempting. Krishna's pastimes of sporting have no rival in this world. The intelligent person realizes that living entities have this sporting propensity because they're part of Krishna. In Krishna, you have the unlimited sporting propensity. Therefore, if you're at all attached to sports and games, then you should become qualified to hear and meditate upon Krishna's sporting pastimes in the forests of Vrindavan. Then you'll truly be satisfied. Now, tonight I want to discuss a subject that can give us a lot of trouble. We're going to discuss a crucial aspect of the spiritual lifestyle. That is, how much should you strive for material advancement? Should you endeavor at all? Or should you do nothing? Should you endeavor very vigorously? And if so, for how long? These questions are very crucial, especially for so many of you who have taken up the process of bhakti yoga, but you may be concerned how to balance the spiritual progress with the so-called material progress, and how much material progress, if such a thing exists, is necessary. These questions are dealt with in Srimad Bhagavatam. We're going to hear some lessons from Sri Shukadev Goswami, and we'll discuss how to apply those lessons in our life. Now, before we turn to hear from Srila Shukadev, let us discuss a contemporary situation which more and more is on the mind of those who are thinking about the world. That subject is happiness. Just a couple of years ago, the United Nations published its report on human existence, and all the nations were ranked according to their qualification in giving a good life to their people. So the leaders of India were very upset that they didn't rank as high as they wanted. In fact, India was ranked just a little bit above Pakistan, which was considered a great insult. So the chief minister at that time, before the last big election, he was the minister in charge of human resources. So he commented, this survey, this research by the United Nations, it's not appropriate. It's just dealing with material things. What about the spiritual creativity of India? That was not included. If that would have been included, then we would have been on the top. So what is that spiritual creativity, that spiritual wisdom? The subject of happiness is perplexing the greatest scholars in the world. It has suddenly dawned upon them that just because your nation has a very high GNP, gross national product, that doesn't mean the people are happy. They've just figured this out, you see. Statistics show that since World War II, the GNP of so many nations has skyrocketed astronomically in 60 years. But the level of happiness of the people, no matter how you measure it, has remained the same. So now, the academics are scratching their heads. What's going on here? We have seen the most extraordinary jump in production, consumerism. Yet we have not seen one slight increase in the measurable happiness of the people in 60 years. In fact, many statistics are showing a skyrocketing in anxiety and depression. I just saw a survey from Australia. Maybe some of you, after you finish university, you may go to Australia. Of course, now so many jobs in Australia are being outsourced to India. But still, some of you may go to Australia. In this report, it said that 50% of the working, 50% of the workforce in Australia at the end of the year, that means Christmas time, end of December, they feel totally burned out and exhausted, and they wonder, how can we go on another year? The pressure is so intense. The managers threaten their employees. You must work more. You must work harder, or this whole enterprise will shift to India. Yes, it's happening. You have to show that you're worthy to have these jobs, or we'll just shift everything to India and you'll be left out in the street. So they're always pushing the people. You have to do your part to do more work. And then the people notice that they're doing more work, and their managers are getting big bonuses for reducing costs. The people are doing more work for the same pay, and the managers are the ones who are saying, we're all together in this. We're all, you know, part of the same team, reducing costs, increasing productivity, getting the, you know, the staff fired up. But then the staff notices when it's bonus time, it all goes to the managers. They don't get anything. All they get is another year of anxiety that, oh, any month now, all the work can be outsourced to India. A devotee who works in Melbourne, he's from Mumbai, Nityananda Priya, he was telling me he worked for IBM, and so a big managemental guru from IBM was sent from the USA to Australia to fire up the IT people there. 300 of them were gathered in an auditorium. This managemental guru for IBM, he's an Indian man who made it big So he was pacing up and down the aisles amongst these 200 or 300 IT workers. And he was telling them, who are the kind of staff we're going to retain in this business? What is the type of person we're going to retain? Are you afraid for your jobs? Do you want to know what is the kind of person that is going to last? I'll tell you. I'm going to go up and down the aisle. I'm going to look each one of you in the eye and ask you, when you first wake up in the morning and open your eyes, do you think of your job? If you do, we want you. If you don't, we don't want you. I want to know, when you wake up in the morning, when your eyes open, is the first thought on your mind your job? If you have no future. Yes, this is going on. The squeezing the people so tight because they're so fearful. All the jobs are disappearing overseas. So more and more, the question is, what is happiness? How do we measure it? Now the latest social science is called the science of happiness. And at leading universities all over the world, they now have professors of happiness. It's become such a mystical thing. People don't know how to be happy anymore. You have to study at university. Even academic journals are now published, Journal of Happiness Studies. Everyone's wondering, what is it? Of course, the material definition of happiness is hard to pin down. We know, as devotees, why the material definition of happiness is hard to pin down, because material happiness is so insubstantial, it's flickering. It's like smoke in the air. You try to grab smoke, and you think you've got something in your grip. You open your hand, and there's nothing there. So, even in the same language, often it's difficult to describe what happiness is. And scholars have admitted that they have uncovered 15 possible definitions of happiness for them to argue about at their conferences. So this is the symptom of the times we're living in. No one can agree on what is happiness. They distinguish between happiness and satisfaction because in their research they've noted that someone can be in a so-called happy mood, but that doesn't mean they're satisfied with their life. So these researchers have devised various techniques for how to truly see if someone's happy. First of all, they ask you just at the particular moment, are you happy right now? Right now, are you happy? What do you say? Yes or no? Are you happy? But then they think that could be just a mood of the moment. It may not be indicating the state of your whole life. So then they will approach you at random times during the week and ask you again, are you happy? And they take an average. But still, they're afraid that they're not getting the true insight. So then what they do is they go ask your friends and relatives, do you think he's happy? But it's even more complicated because they have to also consider maybe that the relative or friend who they asked, is he happy? Maybe they're colored by a particular mood of the moment. So they have to ask them at various times during the week and take an average. This way, life is getting so complicated. And then you take various societies according to their social conditions. There's different negative influences on the so-called happiness of the people. Just like in some countries, take Peru, for example. There, the poor people have been measured to be happier than the middle class. Why is that? Because the upper class is so rich. And the middle class naturally wants to imitate the rich class, but it's such a big jump that it's practically impossible for them to make that step, and therefore they suffer, they're miserable. Whereas the poor people, they're identifying or they're aspiring for the middle class, which is more practical for them. Therefore they're happier. Even though they're poor, they're happier than the middle-class people. You see, this is madness. And then in the Western countries, which supposedly have such high material indicators of happiness, you also have the highest suicide rates. And how do you compare happiness according to the Western standard, especially the American standard, with happiness according to an Asian standard like Japan? The American standard is happiness means you are achieving, you're projecting yourself, you're acquiring things, and you're becoming famous for it. That's happiness in the American sense. But happiness according to the Japanese sense is different. In Japan, you don't identify happiness with your own achievement. You identify happiness with, do my friends like me? Am I doing my duty to my relatives? Do my relatives all agree that I'm fulfilling my duties to them? Am I fulfilling my obligations to society? That way, they define happiness. So, after all is said and done, and all these different possible types of happiness are analyzed, the universal conclusion is that although there has been an extraordinary jump in the gross national product, there has been no increase in happiness, and in fact, there's been so much more stress, so much more anxiety. This should teach us something. We want to know how to aim our life. We want to know how to strive, how to endeavor. This requires guidance. Otherwise, you may become confused. You may think Krishna consciousness means inactivity, irresponsibility, fatalism. Or you may think Krishna consciousness means constant endeavor and striving in a material way. You may mistake material advancement for spiritual advancement. How can that be? Just like in the USA, there is something called the Protestant work ethic. You know, Protestant is a type of Christian. You know, there's Catholics and there's the Protestants. So part of the doctrine of many Protestants is work is good. If you have a job and you are working, then you are a good person and Jesus loves you. And if you don't have a job, it means you're not a good person and you're probably going to hell. So, this is mistaking material advancement for spiritual advancement. Okay. Let us hear what Srila Shukadev says about how we should live. We're going to analyze this verse, which is in the second canto, chapter 2, The Lord in the Heart, text 3. Atakavir namasu yavad arta syat apramato vyavasaya bhuji Siddhenyatatena yatetra tatra parishramang tatra samikshamanah. Translation. For this reason, the enlightened person should endeavor only for the minimum necessities of life while in the world of names. He should be intelligently fixed and never endeavor for unwanted things, being competent to perceive practically that all such endeavors are merely hard labor for nothing. Now, let us analyze this verse. Kavi, the enlightened person. This is what you all want to be. You want to be enlightened. That means you can see in the darkness. Try to understand that even though life in this material world seems to be illuminated, there are lights, there's the sun and the moon. Actually, this is a place of darkness where you cannot see your identity, where you cannot see your connection to Krishna. To be enlightened means, even though this is a world of darkness, you can see these essential things. You can see your spiritual identity. You can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead's energies everywhere. This is what you're striving for, to be a kavi, to be an enlightened person. Just like Lord Brahma is known as Adi Kavi, the original enlightened person. So, we are coming in the disciplic succession, the line of teachers and students, parampara, from Brahma. So, you can be a kavi, just like Brahma is the Adi Kavi. What is it that the enlightened person, the kavi, knows? And how is a kavi trained? Where is the institution for training kavis? This is what the government should be doing, providing genuine institutions where persons can take up the career of being enlightened. So, ata kavir namasu yavat arta. The enlightened person behaves in a certain way while in this material world. And Shukadeva Goswami describes that this world is a world of names only. Namasu. In other words, it's just basic Maya with different names. Basic material ingredients mixed into this permutation, that permutation, but it's the same basic material energy. When the material energy is in one form, you become attracted. When it's in another form, you become repelled. But it's the same matter. You just give it so many different names. Think about it. This is an arm. This is a microphone. This is a cup. This is a table. It's all composed of the material energy. Why, with your short human form of life, should you become lost in this world of names? You all, so many are students. You're studying different things. That's all right. But don't become lost in the study of the world of names. It is not your main career in life. It is supportive. We'll discuss that more later. Atakavir namasu yavadarta syat apramato vyavasaya buddhi. While in this world of names, which is very bewildering, you should not become mad. You should endeavor just for the minimum. Now, what is that minimum? This requires guidance. If we say, just endeavor for the minimum necessities of life, that minimum will have different interpretations in different places for different persons. This is why spiritual guidance is required. Does that minimum mean that you should not work at all? Does that minimum mean you should not earn any money? The minimum is different according to one's ashram, according to one's social setting. So guidance is required. Otherwise, it is true that bhakti yoga can appear to be very difficult to execute in this world. But with guidance, you can understand what is your minimum. You have to take into account what are the resources and wealth that come to you without extreme endeavor. You have to take into account how you want to have time in your life for studying about Krishna, for increasing your attachment for Krishna and his devotees. So you have to weigh all those factors and take guidance how to come up with the proper minimum. And you can be fooled if you don't understand the transcendental science properly. You can see perhaps a devotee is wealthy and you may think, well, he's way beyond the minimum, but you may not see how all that wealth and time is used for Krishna's service. We're all coming into this world with different karmas, and that karma manifests as different amounts of wealth and resources available. So what is easily available for one person is not easily available for another. This is a crucial point to understand, the ease by which the resources and the wealth is available. This will clear up a lot of problems. Rather than look at, he has so much money, I have a little bit of money, therefore how can you equate my minimum with his minimum? It's not about that so much. And this is a subtle point that many people miss in terms of trying to understand Krishna consciousness. It's all about the ease by which the resources come to you. Because when it comes easy, that leaves you with the free mind and the free time for pushing on with your Krishna consciousness. When it comes in a very difficult, anxiety-filled, and stressed way, that means it's not your minimum. It means you're over-endeavoring. Now, of course, if you're studying at the university, it may be that for a few years you have to intensely endeavor. Yes. But we're talking about over a longer period of time. Therefore, guidance is required. You have to know when enough is enough. Just like Raghunath Das, associate of Lord Chaitanya, he wanted to leave home, but it wasn't the right time. Lord Chaitanya told him, just go on with your material affairs, but you always think within your heart of Krishna. Don't be fanatical. The right moment will come. And indeed, a year or two later, that right moment came. Guidance is required in all cases. We need the sharp vision of a seasoned expert in Krishna consciousness who can look and tell you, this, you're endeavoring too hard. It's an over-endeavor. You don't have to push yourself like this. Or, sometimes it happens, you should get this duty done and out of the way. And you can do it while maintaining your Krishna consciousness. Both situations are possible. But without guidance, we'll easily become bewildered. We'll go to one extreme or the other. That is the tendency in the material world. You either say, okay, I drop everything, or else you say, I just do everything till I kill myself. One extreme or the other. But the science of yukta vairagya, real renunciation, cannot be understood by us without guidance. So let us hear more of what Shukadeva Goswami is saying. He's warning you, don't become mad. What is the nature of that madness? You find that in the world today. No one wants to just take what comes easy. No one can be content with what they have. You have to be motivated to always increase. Get more. Don't be satisfied staying at the same level of material achievement. Indeed, people are made to feel that they are backwards and uncivilized if they are satisfied with what they have. This is the work of a demoniac system. Why demoniac? Why such a strong word? Because there is a purposeful intent to make sure no one can be satisfied with what they have. There's a constant agitation. You have to get more. You have to improve. If you can understand this core principle, you'll see into the heart of what's troubling people today. This madness is also infecting India, as you know. Don't be satisfied with simple things. How dare you be so barbaric? Always think of how you could have more and more and better and better. This is demoniac. And such an influence destroys people's chances to become a covey, to become enlightened. It even affects our devotees because it's in the atmosphere. It's a influence that is very powerful. Therefore, our devotees must have guidance how to do things precisely for Krishna's pleasure, how to do the material duties, how to execute the spiritual responsibilities, how not to go to one extreme or the other. This requires very expert counsel, especially in this day and age when there is so much pressure that you should be dissatisfied with your status quo. If you're satisfied with your status quo, you're looked down. People look down upon you. So what are you going to get next? What are you going to buy next? How are you rising on the corporate ladder? How old is your car? How old is your computer? When are you going to change? Better and better is always coming. Look at your clothes. Have you got into fashion yet? Or are you just buying ordinary clothes? Have you started shopping at a boutique yet for your clothes? What about your eating habits? Are you just eating the same basic diet? Diversify, variegate, advance. How many varieties of consumer goods do you have in your home? Most of all, how many time-saving devices do you have in your home? Have you noticed that the so-called time-saving devices take up so much time? But this is how your mind is agitated. You don't have enough time-saving devices in your home. You're still doing things by hand. I remember growing up as a young lad in the 50s, at that time, you know, the Soviet Union was considered a big threat. And so both the capitalists and the communists were making the same propaganda. Through capitalism, people will eventually have so much leisure time. The work week will reduce. People will have ample time to spend at the beach, in the forest, watching television. They'll have so much time. And the communists were saying the same thing. Through communism, the work week will shrink and fade away. Now, what is the reality that's happened? No matter what ism people are following, they're working harder than ever before with more anxiety than ever. That's why Prahlad Maharaj in the Bhagavatam says, Maya Sukhaya Bharam Udvahato Vimudhan. Vimudha. Not ordinary fool, but super fool. That is what we have today. This is progress. Instead of an ordinary fool, you have Vimudha, super fool. What is the characteristic of the super fool? To carry with great agony an unnecessary burden. Maya Sakaya Bharam. It's bad enough to labor under a real burden, but to struggle under a false imagined burden, this is crazy. And that's what's going on today. What is that false burden, that Maya Sakaya? The attitude that I have to have more, better, different. I can't be satisfied with what I have. Just like in the USA. They move so many times. The average family moves at least 3 or 4 times in life, changing houses. Mm-hmm. That's considered progress. Change house, get a better house. It'll be closer to this, it'll be closer to that. It'll have an office for the father and a game room for the children. They're always thinking like that. Meanwhile, then, more than 50% of the marriages break apart. So they're moving the family here or there. Then the family is breaking apart, and they have to sell the house and split the assets between the divorced husband and wife. And it's crazy. So this is progress. All this madness comes about because people are being trained to be dissatisfied with what they have. You've got to catch this in action. And what are we doing in Krishna consciousness? We are training people to be satisfied materially with what you have, but to push ahead with your Krishna conscious endeavors. Now, what does it mean to be satisfied with what you have materially? Does that mean you shouldn't go to university? Or does that mean you shouldn't have a family? No. Those things are there for most persons, but guidance is required. Even these few who decide to be brahmacharis, they're striving, but in a spiritual sense. No one can just be lazy and do nothing. The art of how to endeavor, the art of how to strive, is something that has to be learned from an expert Krishna conscious person. How not to go to one extreme or the other. One attitude that must be mastered is to be satisfied with your material situation. See what comes easy without extreme stress and anxiety. If great wealth comes to you easily with a minimum endeavor, okay, use it for Krishna's service. If not, be satisfied with what you have and use that for Krishna's service. Krishna knows. You can easily give me $1 million. I'll take it. Or you can easily give me 2 flowers. I'll take it. Krishna accepts both equally. So this is the basis of a real economy. See what each person can achieve in this world without anxiety, without stress. Now, counseling, guidance is required to live like that. Hmm. It's different for different persons. Someone may easily be able to give millions of dollars. Someone may only be able to easily give a few flowers. But Krishna sees it all as the same. Krishna is looking at the bhakti. If you are saving time in your life for glorifying Krishna, that is the most productive way to live. But as long as you're in contact with this demoniac artificial stimulation that stirs you up, don't be satisfied with what you have. You're civilized. You're progressive. You've got to have more, better, newer. I'm sure some of you have dabbled into this kind of pushing. And once you get into it, you can't get out of it. Very difficult. We want to educate people so that they can protect themselves. The best vaccination against this infection of material desire is Krishna consciousness. Once you are spiritually satisfied, you'll wonder, what do I need with material progress, material advancement? I don't need it. My life is advancing on the spiritual platform. Let my material circumstances be peaceful, stress-free, so that I can cultivate my spiritual life. Now, we talked about Sukadeva Goswami explaining the madness. Apramatta. Don't be mad after material dissatisfaction. What does Lord Rishabhdev say in the fifth canto of Bhagavatam? Nunam pramatta kurute vikarma yarindriya pritaya apranoti. When the living entity considers sense gratification to be the goal of life, he becomes mad and commits sinful activities. This madness is what we're very, very afraid of. And that is why we have the Association of Devotees, to keep ourselves from succumbing to this madness of perpetual dissatisfaction. I need more. I need newer. I need better. Unfortunately, society today is encouraging you like this. Your family, your friends, relatives put so much pressure on you. How bigger is your house going to get? How many more time-saving machines are you going to get? How much more money are you going to get? The more money you get, the more you'll have to leave behind for your children. When does it stop? We require lifestyle counselors who can give us pinpoint advice how to do the necessary without falling victim to this demoniac influence. It is very critical to have such advice, such guidance. Otherwise, it's impossible to keep your footing in the mad rushing stream of today's culture. Sukadeva Goswami says, Syada Pramato Vyavasaya Buddhi. You have to learn how to have fixed intelligence. Vyavasaya Buddhi. As Krishna himself explains in Bhagavad Gita, Vyavasayatmika Buddhi Ekeha Kurunandana. You have to have focused intelligence. That intelligence is focused on the goal of bhakti, serving Krishna. Otherwise, what is the nature of those who are lost in the mad world of names? Bahu shaka hyanantascha budeo vivasainam. Their intelligence is splayed out, many branched. You can't count all the different branches because their intelligence is agitated by newer, better, bigger, more. A devotee, because he has this vyavasaya buddhi, fixed intelligence, can remain solidly established in simple living and high thinking, even when there are disturbances in material nature. You see, even for devotees, the material world is not a utopia. There's always going to be upsets and upheavals, even when you try to live simply. But a devotee knows, that's life in this world. Let me remain fixed in my conclusion that Krishna is the proprietor of everything and I am Krishna's humble servant. I'll just do the best I can in any circumstance. So don't make the mistake and think that just because you're a devotee, you'll never see any upheavals in the material world. The nature of the material world is upheaval. So you must see them, but don't let it disturb your intelligence. Remain fixed in your conclusion that I am Krishna's servant. I'll live simply. Now, how do you know you're living simply? Guidance is required. Once again, look at your life and see what comes easy, what resources come easy in that trying for them doesn't upset my Krishna consciousness. This requires guidance. I've seen both cases. On the one side, I've seen persons endeavoring extremely while trying to be Krishna conscious. They're endeavoring for some attainment, and it's causing them so much anxiety and disturbance. And I've also seen those practicing Krishna consciousness who they have some duty they should do, some studying or some job, but just out of artificial renunciation, they're saying, oh, I'm too spiritual to do that. So guidance is required, how to be successful practicing bhakti yoga in this material world. I can give an example about the latter. In Australia, New Zealand, where I'm based some of the time, there are devotees who have jobs as programmers in IT, and the nature of that job is that you can come in any time, make your own hours, and you have your own cubicle, and just get the work done on time, and no one bothers you. Whether you come in at 4 in the morning, or midnight, or 8 o'clock at night, you can make your own hours. You don't associate with anyone, you just have your cubicle and your computer, and you work. So, several times I've seen such devotees take this kind of job very casually. Oh, it's Maya. I just can't. It's so hard leaving the devotees, leaving Bhagavatam class and going to that job. This artificial, enthusiastic talk. And then I notice they start to become slack in their job performance and even risking having such a job, which is actually so easy to perform in relation to their Krishna consciousness. Because half the time, while they're at their cubicle, supposedly doing their programming, you know, they're surfing various Krishna conscious websites, listening to lectures, downloading this picture of Krishna, downloading that lecture. So I said, why do you want to risk this kind of job? I said, no, let me ask you this. Are you ready for the Brahmacharya Ashram?
No, Maharaj.
Okay, so then, here you have the perfect job for your Krishna consciousness. You can make your hours anytime you want. Occasionally there are the heavy deadlines, but you can make your, you can go to the morning program, you can go to this festival, that festival. You don't have to associate with anybody, it's just you and your computer and your cubicle. It's fine for your Krishna consciousness. Why do you want to risk losing this job? There's no point to it. So that's I found that several times. I've had to point out that you're very foolish to give up this kind of job. And then you can go to the other extreme. I've seen devotees who have this idea, I'm going to make a lot of money. I'm just going to go all out for 5 or 10 years. And then I'll have so much money. And when people see that I have so much money, and I also say Hare Krishna, then they'll want to be devotees. What example did they used to? They used to, I remember in Los Angeles when I was a young brahmacharya there, some devotees would tell me like that, we're going to do just like Krishna did to the Keshi demon. We're going to go deep inside materialistic society with our non-stop round-the-clock work, which will impress all the materialists when they see that we're working 20 hours a day. they'll be attracted. And we're going to go deep inside material existence, and then just like Krishna did to the Keshi demon, we're going to expand our fist. And what usually happens, though? They get swallowed up completely. I've seen they'll every 3 months they'll come to the temple, and it's going to happen any moment. We're going to make it big. We're going to have so much money. We just have to work a little bit harder, harder, and then we'll be famous, and everyone will see it, and they'll want to be Krishna conscious. Of course, in the process of all this extreme endeavor, they lose their Krishna consciousness and they disappear. So these are two types of illusion that can be avoided simply by taking good guidance. How to live in the world of names and make progress in bhakti. How not to become mad. How to endeavor in the minimum way. That minimum takes some expertise to see. We don't want to renounce things that can be used for Krishna's service, nor do we want to take on endeavors that could destroy our Krishna consciousness. In other words, what I'm telling you is that bhakti is very personal. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and you are his personal parts and parcels. Because bhakti is 100% a personal process, personal guidance is required at all times. He should be intelligently fixed and never endeavor for unwanted things. Being competent to perceive practically that all such endeavors are merely hard labor for nothing. I have a cousin. He just retired from 30 years of being a top administrator in the health department in Washington, D.C. He was in charge of the Department of Records, all the births and all the deaths. He was in charge of all the certificates. So for 30 years, he had this pride that our department is so efficient in producing birth records and death records. He would just go on and on and on talking about birth certificates, death certificates, birth. It was like an obsession for him. Anyone he would meet, he would just, you know, let me tell you about our latest system for processing birth certificates. This was his life and soul. This is where his utsaha, his enthusiasm came from. Even his own wife would sometimes have to tell him, will you stop, will you shut up, stop talking about this. So, he retired after 30 years. They allowed him to retire early. He took a good offer. So, he was 55. He bailed out. And so then, he was telling me, okay, now I'm retired. I'm going to really make good use of this retirement. I'm just going to enjoy the peaceful life. So I said, I just want to ask you some questions, you know, just for my own personal research. Looking back over the 30 years, what are your realizations? He said, my realizations are that the whole struggle wasn't worth it. I said, what do you mean? How could you say that? He said, well, the effort that you make doesn't equal the reward you get. It's just not worth it. I said, well, you're telling me this after a 30-year career. Why did you go so far? Why, you know, 30 years, then retire, and you come to all these conclusions? He said, you don't understand. When you're in it, it's impossible to get out of it. Because the nature of the culture is such that it perpetuates itself. Everyone is always encouraging you, motivating you to do more. You're encouraged to put yourself forward as the kind of person at the job who can be depended on. You want to be known as the go-to person. When we've got a problem, we go to him. He can solve it. And in this way, you get a good, you know, recommendation. You get a good, your file becomes full of commendations. You become attached to all that. You have to keep it up. It's just the culture that is, the passion is just pushing this on and on. And you don't want your reputation to sink. You have to always, you know, feed this image. I can do it. You want me to stay at work 2 more hours? No problem. I'll get it done. You want me to come in on Saturday? Okay, of course. Yeah, it's got to be done. Yeah, you can count on me. That kind of thing just goes on and on, year after year. You can't say no. Once you start saying yes, you can't say no. It's very sinister how this works. Maybe some of you have some experience already. Yeah, anyone? Yeah, it's very sinister, isn't it? Once you get into it, you can't get out. So my cousin, he was kind of chastising me, like, because I asked him, like, well, 30 years, and now you're telling me it all wasn't worth it. Why didn't you drop it? Why didn't you do something else? He said, you don't understand. You can't. Just one thing leads to another. You get a commendation, you get a little promotion, a tiny increase in salary, and you become attached. Yeah, I'm doing my job good. I know the job better than anyone. You know, that kind of artificial pride, maybe some of you have already felt it, yes? When it comes to that job, I know it. It's just a matter of time before, you know, the higher-ups notice me. Right? I'm going places with this company. Right? So once you get into that, it's hard to get out of it. So he became known as the go-to person. Whenever there's a problem, you know, call him. He'll get it done. And so this went on for 30 years. Think about it. He couldn't say no. So I asked him, well, you became known as the go-to person, the competent one who would get the job done. Was there a commensurate increase in salary? He said, get real. It's never like that. You're just supposed to be mainly happy with this mental satisfaction of being competent. And you're supposed to be satisfied with your fame at your workplace that, you know, you're expert. He said, that's the main thing they want to pay you with. Yes, he said, there was an increase in pay, but it all wasn't worth it. The main thing, he said, that kept me going on and on, decade after decade, is this whole mental culture of commendation, appreciation, feeling self-worth, feeling dignity that I'm expert in this job. When they want something done, they call me. That sense of material self-dignity. So it's very interesting. He explained to me like that. He said, looking back now, I can say it wasn't worth it, but I couldn't get out of it. Anyway, now, he said, I'm going to just live a peaceful life of retirement. I'm 55. I'm just going to, I don't know what I'm going to do, he said, but I'm just, whatever it is, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to, you know, be peaceful. Of course, he had no idea what he was going to do. That means a year later, what did he tell me? You know, I've just decided to start my own business because, you know, I mean, one has to keep the brain sharp as you get older, you know. You have to exercise the brain. So, you know, I just want to start a business just to, you know, I mean, it's not going to be too much, you know, just to keep the, you know, keep the brain cells turning over, you know. I know what that means. It means he's bored being at home. So I'm telling you these things so you'll think about it. You have to define your goals and your level of immersion. How much is enough and how much is too much? It's not worth it. This requires guidance. It's different for each one of you. Some of you are students. Some of you are already working. So in conjunction with your counselor, you have to analyze what is the appropriate level of absorption in these duties. It's different for each one. Situations for one person are very easy, for another are very difficult. Just like the example I gave about the computer programmers. Yeah. The ones who haven't been downsized in the West yet. Such a conducive job for being Krishna conscious. So sometimes I had to point that out to them. Then again, someone else is on the other extreme. You know, big plans. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to have so much money. And then I'll be Krishna conscious. Because when I'm famous and have so much money, people will respect me. They'll listen to me. And then I can tell them about Krishna. But most of them never, practically all of them, never get to that level because they lose their Krishna consciousness in the process. So this is a contemporary explanation of Shukadeva Goswami's instruction. Atta kavir namasu yavadarta syat apramato vyavasaya buddhi siddhenya tartena yateta tatra parishramam tatra samikshamana. For this reason, the enlightened person should endeavor only for the minimum necessities of life while in the world of names. He should be intelligently fixed and never endeavor for unwanted things, being competent to perceive practically that all such endeavors are merely hard labor for nothing. Let's hear a little bit of Srila Prabhupada's purport. The Bhagavad Dharma, or the cult of Srimad Bhagavatam, is perfectly distinct from the way of fruitive activities, which are considered by the devotees to be merely a waste of time. The whole universe, or for that matter, all material existence, is moving on as jagat, simply for planning business to make one's position very comfortable or secure, although everyone can see that this existence is neither comfortable nor secure, and can never become comfortable or secure at any stage of development. Those who are captivated by the illusory advancement of material civilization, following the way of phantasmagoria, are certainly madmen. The whole material creation is a jugglery of names only. In fact, it is nothing but a bewildering creation of matter, like earth, water, fire. The buildings, furniture, cars, bungalows, mills, factories, industries, peace, war, or even the highest perfection of material science, namely atomic energy and electronics, are all simply bewildering names of material elements with their concomitant reactions of the three modes. Since the devotee of the Lord knows them perfectly well, he is not interested in creating unwanted things for a situation which is not at all reality, but simply names of no more significance than the babble of sea waves. So my appeal to you all is to take your lifestyle very seriously, take Krishna conscious guidance, and intelligently make your way through this world of names. Think about it. How materialistic society is trying to perpetually make you dissatisfied. You have to have more, newer, better, different. They want you to think that you can't go back to your home and just see the same furniture year after year. The walls are the same color year after year, the same clothes in year after year. This, they say, is ignorance. This is barbarian life. You must change. Change the style of your clothes. Change the furniture in your house. Change the gadgets. Change your hairstyle. Change, change, change all the time. And then you're progressing. By becoming a mad consumer, they even tell you, you are doing your national duty as a good citizen. You're helping the economy go. During a so-called mini recession in the USA, the politicians were actually telling the people that if you want to do your duty to the country, consume more to help get the economy going again. When you purchase, when you buy, you're actually being patriotic. Do people actually believe this? So I ask you to please think deeply about your lifestyle, how it's going. Of course, when you meditate on Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, the sweetness overwhelms you. Life is so simple. Everyone in Vrindavan is simply satisfied with Krishna. Vrindavan is just a simple agricultural village. The land, the cows, Krishna and his flute, Krishna's devotees. In this way you can understand. The real wealth is love of Krishna. The prema dana. What does Narottam Das Thakur say? Golokera prema dana harinam sankirtan. this Harinam, Sankirtan, is the treasure that's come down from Golok. The prema dana, the treasure of love of God. The more that that prema dana is in your life, it's easy to live simply because you have real wealth. You have real advancement. This is Lord Chaitanya's mercy. To make the prema dana so easily available in the worst, most degraded age. All right. Any questions? I think it's very warm for you, yes? Here? No? It's okay? All right.
Thank you for a very nice inspirational class, Maharaj. I wanted to ask you if I know that it's a rare thing to find in this lately, especially in the world we live today, that someone is satisfied with the work he has. But you also mentioned one example, which is a very nice thing, that you can practice your Krishna consciousness and your work is not getting on the way.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is that if I was thinking about this a lot, that His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Swami gave a nice example how we sometimes instead of giving Krishna Bhoga, we give him prasadam. We enjoy our work, and then like we are giving results to Krishna. But actually, it's like we are giving prasadam, our prasadam to Krishna, because we already enjoy it. I know it's a rare thing, but and the question is how we. So I was thinking about this, and then I realized that, okay, now it's not the thing that I should now work something that I don't like, that is like very hard for, that is, I don't enjoy my work, but actually I should keep working what I have, like you said, this, with the minimal, I don't know the English word, with the minimal...
minimum endeavor?
Endeavor, yeah. With a minimum endeavor, and then but the thing is that if how we can make this that we are not giving Krishna prasadam, but actually we just know that. I think you get the question. Yeah.
As I said, everyone requires guidance, because these situations of working in this world, studying in this world, can become quite complex to the beginner. But for someone who is mature in Krishna consciousness, they can easily see what the situation is and help you. That this is an over-endeavor. You're trying for something that is causing you great danger to your spiritual life. Or you're being lazy and artificially renounced. You have a good situation for supporting yourself and practicing Krishna consciousness. Keep it. Stay with it. Guidance is required. That is the point. Yes?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, how can we know whether what we are doing in our job, like we are trying to enjoy it on our own, or we are actually detached in trying to give the results to Krishna?
So we're going to establish a secret police here that's going to go and... investigate all of you, make sure you're not enjoying your work or your studies. How many of you are miserable at your studies and work? Krishna says that is Krishna consciousness. How many of you are you're feeling okay at your work or your studies? Raise your hand. Oh, we're going to get you. This is not the point. Now I can answer that question in a deeper way, although what I was saying was alluding to something deep. You see, there is a thin line between, a very subtle difference between karma yoga and bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga actually, in of itself, means pure love of Krishna. You're just doing something 100% simply for Krishna's pleasure. Karma yoga means you're attached to what you're doing, but you'll give the result to Krishna. For most people, I always explain, they should look up to karma yoga, not look down at it. Let us not be artificial. Karma yoga is an exalted thing. Prabhupada explains, it's just a subtle line between karma yoga and bhakti. Very subtle. Mm-hmm. Now, most persons should look up to karma yoga. Yes, I'm going to give the results of what I'm doing to Krishna. Now, as you become more advanced in Krishna consciousness, naturally you become more concerned about the purity of your relationship with Krishna. And then you start thinking, not only should Krishna enjoy the results of what I'm doing, but Krishna should also enjoy my choice of what I'm doing. In other words, the true bhakti yogi is not attached to the results or the activity. But that is, it takes some advancement to get to that point. So meanwhile, if someone says they like their studies or like their job, we're not going to persecute them. Okay? Is that all right? We're not going to give you some kind of hang-up. Ooh, you like your job. You like what you're studying. We'll get you. We've got a special torture room here for you. We'll get it out of you. Better you study something you hate. That'll be Krishna consciousness. Take a job you hate. That's real bhakti. Well, no. We're not interested in this. This is why I say, once again, guidance is required. A devotee is actually neither averse nor attached. A devotee is just looking to see what gives Krishna pleasure. You begin your devotional life by giving the results to Krishna for his pleasure. And as you make advancement, then you start considering more and more. Am I doing what Krishna wants? Besides giving Krishna the results of what I am doing, am I actually doing things the best way for Krishna's pleasure? You'll come to that point. I remember when I'll give you an example. When I was just coming to Krishna consciousness, early, I think the end of 1972, I had gone to the temple one time. I had been reading Prabhupada's books for 6 months. So I had this brilliant idea to spread Krishna consciousness throughout the world. I thought I should go and make some buttons, you know, the buttons you pin on you, that say Hare Krishna, and that'll do it. So on my own, I went and I spent a couple hundred dollars, and I had about several hundred buttons made up, you know, a beautiful lavender color, and then Hare Krishna in white in a very nice typeface. And so I thought, wow, this is great idea. And I brought the boxes of buttons to the temple, and I presented them to one devotee, and, well, I could understand later, she didn't actually give the proper reaction. I gave her the boxes of buttons very proudly. Yes, just see, I'm giving these to you all. Yeah, aren't they nice? And she looked at them and said, why did you do this? You should have just given the money. I was like, I didn't say anything, but I was like really let down. Like, I mean, this is a great idea. This is for Krishna. Beautiful Hare Krishna buttons. This is what will save the world. had gone on my own. I had gone to a button factory, had these buttons designed and made. Voluntary service. And I handed her the boxes, and she just, "What? Why did you do this? Why didn't you just give us the money?" So obviously, after a few more weeks of purification, I began to realize on my own that it's best to see what service Krishna wants from me. But was I wrong to do what I did in the beginning? No, it was, I was trying in my own way to start some service to Krishna. Obviously, later I would mature and realize that Hare Krishna buttons are not going to save the world. Very soon thereafter, I realized to save the world, I should be distributing Srila Prabhupada's books. So I did. But, you have to start somewhere. So I think you get the point. Any other questions? Yes?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. When I see people doing very nicely, I get attracted by their personality, by the way they behave, by the way they act, and they are, quite attractive. So I think, yeah, this person is very nice. What he only lacks is Krishna consciousness. So how to purify this thinking process?
Yes, you'll see examples in the material sphere of activities of persons doing things nicely, and it is true. If only they were doing it for Krishna, that's true. I like to give the example, if you ever fly on, I don't know if any of you ever flown on Singapore Airlines, who raise your hands. They're world famous for the service attitude of their flight crew. If you're sitting, even you're in the economy section and you're sitting and you just look at one of the flight attendants and just move an eyebrow immediately.
Yes.
What can I do for you, sir? Really? They're world famous for that. So they can teach you the attitude that a devotee should have in serving Krishna. They're so on top of how everyone's feeling and any tiny desire you may have. Is that all right, sir? Are you satisfied? Is there anything more I could get you? So that's an example. I can give you another example. I think I've explained it here before. IBM. They're generally famous for their service. So I once thought I had a problem with my IBM laptop. And so I called up IBM. I was in Sydney, Australia. And I said, it's doing like this, doing like that. What am I going to do? So the lady on the phone said, okay, I've written everything down. I'll call you back in 10 minutes. So 10 minutes later, the phone rang. It was another person. We have just looked at your situation. We want that machine right now. We're going to take a look at it. I said, oh, that's good, but I have no transportation in order to bring the machine to you. Sir, that is not your problem. That is our problem. We will have a courier at your door in exactly 45 minutes. I said, wow, okay. So 45 minutes later, the courier came. Give us the machine. I said, but I don't have any way to pack it. Sir, don't worry about that. We are prepared. Just give us the laptop. We will package it properly. And then the courier took it away. 10 minutes later, IBM calls. Did the courier come on time to get your laptop? Wow, My goodness, this is surrendered service. This is pure bhakti. So I said, yes, yes. The courier took it away. I said, what happens next? We'll take a look at it and we'll call you. We will call you in no more than 2 hours. We'll let you know. Then 5 minutes later, the phone rang. It was someone else from IBM. Were you given an exact time by which they would get back to you? We're just checking. So, I said, yes, okay. 2 hours later, the service department calls. We've looked at your machine, something very suspicious. We're going to do a thorough overhaul. We'll get this machine back to you in 2 days, 48 hours. I said, oh, no, I'm glad that you're fixing it, but I'm leaving tomorrow for the other side of Australia, 4,000 kilometers away. I'm going to Perth on the west coast of Australia. What am I going to do? Once again, sir, that is not your problem. That is our problem. Wherever you go, we will get your machine to you in 2 days. I started thinking, maybe I should take a look at my own devotional service. What's my attitude in serving Krishna? These guys are, they're in Maya, and look at their attitude. And of course, naturally, I mean, from the material point of view, what would I be thinking after getting all that attentive service? I'd be thinking, next laptop I get is definitely going to be an IBM. It's just natural you think like that. So that's you can see examples of how to serve properly in the material world, but it's all for zero. But we can learn how to serve Krishna by seeing such dedication. IBM's attitude is, a problem with a customer is a welcome thing because by solving the problem, you create a lifetime customer. So they have the philosophy of the overkill. You come to them with a problem, they'll just lay it on you, lavish you, just overkill in satisfying you, seeing that problem as an opportunity to create a lifelong relationship. So yes, that can teach you about serving Krishna. At the same time, of course, we feel sorry for persons who are serving the material energy with such dedication, because they're not going to get the reciprocation they want from Maya. What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Moga sha moga karmano moga jnana vichetasaha. Mogasha, all your hopes will be defeated. Moga karmano, all your activities will be frustrated. Moga jnana, all your attempts for knowledge will be thwarted. That's the truth. So what is the use of all that dedication and concentration just to serve the merciless taskmaster, the witch Maya? Still, you can learn that if only I would serve Krishna with just a speck of that determination. You know the example of Bilva Mangala Thakur? How many of you know that? Raise your hands. Okay. He was a fallen Brahmana. He became attached to a prostitute named Chintamani. He was so determined to see her, even when his father died and he was at the funeral of his own father. He was telling the priests, hurry, 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 I have to go somewhere. Hurry, get this over with. Hurry, hurry. So he finished the funeral ceremony very quickly and then went to go see Chintamani. A huge rainstorm outside, wind and rain. He had to cross a river. The river was tossing and turning with huge waves. He still jumped in to cross over. He was almost drowning. He grabbed on to what he thought was a tree trunk to get to the other side. It turned out to be a dead human body. He didn't care. He just kept going. I've got to see her. I've got to see her. He got to the other side of the river, climbed out, and then walked to her house through the storm. Her house was surrounded by a huge wall with a door. He knocked on the door. There was no answer. So he had to go over the wall. To climb over the wall, he grabbed on to what he thought was a vine to get him over the top of the wall surrounding the house. That vine turned out to be a poisonous snake. He didn't care. I've got to see her. He got over the wall and went up to her house, knocked on the door of the house. After some time, Chintamani came to the door, opened it, and she was astonished. Bilva Mangala, what are you doing here on such a stormy night? She said, if only you were as attached to serving Krishna as you are to my body, you'd go back to Godhead in no time. At that moment, Bilva Mangala remembered, I am Krishna's servant. In this way, by the words of this prostitute, his memory of Krishna was revived. So Chintamani told him, just look how you serve the flesh, the temporary, with such determination. If only you would do that for Krishna. Anything else? Okay.
Haribo. Maharaj, what is the spiritual definition of happiness? You're mentioning about material definitions. So what is...
The true definition of happiness for a devotee is Krishna's pleasure. A real devotee has no other way of understanding what is happiness except through the happiness of Krishna. That is true happiness for a true devotee. You have no conception of your own happiness. Everything is simply Krishna's pleasure. Just like for Mother Yashoda in Vrindavan, her whole life is just Krishna's happiness. She's only thinking how to protect Krishna, how to maintain Krishna. That's all. Now, we need the whole process of devotional service to get ourselves to that point of purity where we're simply thinking of Krishna's pleasure. Okay? It's a goal worth a lifetime of endeavor. And Lord Chaitanya makes it possible. Even in this most degraded, maddened time in world history. Yes?
I was wondering how, when there is a desire to perform a particular kind of service that we are attracted to doing and we're pleased to do, but we're told to do something other than that, and that attachment to that other kind of what we like to do is still remaining, to surrender to the service that we're supposed to do as opposed to what we want to do is very difficult, and it's I'm finding it difficult to give up my attachment for my other kind of service and apply that same kind of attachment to the service which I'm supposed to do, which is for my ultimate good. So I'm trying to understand, should I give up my old attachment, or should I wait till later to fulfill it, or is it just a is it a material desire to perform the kind of service that I like as opposed to the kind that I'm given?
What ashram are you in?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know how to answer you then. That could be part of the problem, that you don't know what ashram, you see? Because...
I'd like to be a brahmachari, but we don't know.
If you'd like to be a brahmachari... How do the brahmacharis live here? Is there such a thing as you do the needful of what you're told? Say it. And if some situation comes in which there's some special need,
so. Do the needful and give up the attachment?
Ooh, it depends on what you want. What do you want?
I want to surrender fully and just do whatever it takes to go back to Godhead as soon as possible.
Is that what you really want?
Yeah.
And are you willing to make any sacrifice along the way?
Yeah.
Any of you work here? Anyone have a job here who's working, or you're all in school? How many of you have employers that say to you at the start of every workday, what would you like to do today? Anyone have a job like that? We're here to fulfill your desires. What would you like to do today at the company? Anyone have a job like that? That's why it's often very good for devotees to have some experience in the working world before they live in the ashram in the temple. And then you lose all these fairy tale ideas, you know. How many of you who are working have called your employer and told them, yeah, I'm just a bit on the mental today. I think I'll, don't mind if I come in a few hours late. I ate too much last night at the feast, so. No, you can't say that kind of thing. So, my point is, many of you have experience in performing austerities in the working world. So if you're amongst those who later choose to live an ashram life, you should know that at least you should surrender to Krishna as much as you surrendered in your occupation in the material world. How many of you go to universities where the professors tell you, where the professors tell you, we've got an exam coming up. Why don't you write the questions? Write whatever questions you feel you should answer. No, you've got to do what you're told. Now, of course, in Krishna consciousness, as Shikshastaka was explaining, there is consideration of your propensities, your physical and mental capacities, and your level of advancement in Krishna consciousness at a particular time. Still, there comes a point that when a certain situation is necessary, you have to deal with that situation. Sometimes there are emergencies, sometimes there are just things come up. Also, it can be that you don't really know your propensity right now. I can give an example for myself. When I was a new devotee, I was given the service of distributing books. And I was in such... it was such a challenge for me. I had two emotions simultaneously. I hated it, and I was determined to love it. And I went on and on like that for a couple of years. And then suddenly, I began to love it madly. I didn't want to give it up for anything in the world. And then my body became sick, and I had to stop it. And I was lamenting like anything. The very thing that I was struggling so much with 2 years before, and now I was just madly in love with it. So often we don't know what our propensities are. In the beginning I was thinking, how can I do this service? It's impossible. It's not my propensity. 2 years later, I said, this is the only thing I want to do in my life. Oh, this is the way to go back to Godhead so easily. And then when the service, I had to stop it. I was lamenting, oh no. So sometimes we don't know what we want. Guidance is always required. Krishna is the best employer. That's one thing I can tell you. Krishna will never shortchange you, and Krishna will always give you more than you deserve. After more than 30 years of trying to serve Krishna, I can tell you that is a fact. You can't work for anyone better than Krishna. Through devotional service, you'll discover yourself and your potential. You don't really know your potential. It takes some purification to see what you can actually do best for Krishna's service. So if you really want to discover yourself, if you really want to be all that you can be, then perform devotional service. Devotional service means under guidance. Okay? Why make a big problem out of something that's very simple? Take some guidance. Have your situation looked at. What can you do? What are you capable of doing now? What's needed? Is it possible that can happen in your situation? Right, then you'll live happily ever after. Vishate tadanantaram. Anything else? Jainitai.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you very much for a very enlightening and thought-provoking class. I have one question. I'm just wondering, sometimes we experience that either people were giving guidance, or sometimes we may take guidance from more than one person who gives us seemingly conflicting instructions. How would you comment on maybe taking guidance from more than one person and or dealing with conflicting instructions?
That's why you have a spiritual master who's the bottom line. Advice can vary according to time and circumstance, details of devotional service. You may go to one Vaishnava and he tells you, you can't be a brahmachari if you're doing devotional service surrounded by 20 women. You may go to another Vaishnava and he's like, oh, just transcend, Prabhu. So in cases like that, you have to approach your spiritual master and get the bottom line. Everyone needs someone in their life, you know, who's the bottom line. Otherwise, yeah, things can get a bit, yeah. Our ISKCON society is very variegated with, that's the wealth of our ISKCON society, so many, you know, wonderful personalities. But to keep your life simple while hearing from so many wonderful devotees, if there seems to be a conflict, then you approach your spiritual master to resolve the situation. Is that all right?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I want to understand the statement where he in all and all in him. He in all and all in him.
Where is that statement?
It's in the Gita of Chinmayananda. Explained by Chinmayananda.
Say the statement again.
He in all and all in him. So with my little understanding, I could understand he in all. For example, all those who are present here, he in all, but I'm not able to understand the term all in him.
If you read a clear translation of Bhagavad Gita, that's why we have Bhagavad Gita as it is, you've seen? Huh? You have seen it? You have seen Bhagavad Gita as it is?
Bhagavad Gita as it is.
Yes, as it is.
Yeah, I could understand the meaning behind it.
I also can understand when I read Bhagavad Gita as it is. I understand that Krishna says all living beings are in me and they are mine. They're my parts and parcels. Yeah. Yajgatva na punamoham. He says when you approach a genuine guru, a Krishna bhakta, then you won't be in illusion anymore. Yajgatva na punamoham. What is the symptom that you won't be in illusion anymore? You'll know that all living beings are my parts and parcels. They're mine. Okay? So I advise you to read Bhagavad Gita as it is. Then everything will be clear. You'll do that?
Yeah.
All right. You know, in India, there are so many swamis and, you know, what can I say? But I prefer to read Bhagavad Gita as it is, as Lord Krishna gave it. Okay? That's all right?
Yeah. Thank you.
I recommend that for you.
Fine. Thanks a lot.
All right. I'll give you a further example. When I was a student at Yale University, I was looking for the truth. And indeed, my professors did tell me I could study whatever I wanted. It was an exceptional situation. So I decided, well, I was looking for the truth. What about Hinduism? Well, yeah, I should study that. But there's only one problem, as I've explained before here. The class on Hinduism met at 8 a.m. in the morning. And as a genuine Kali Yuga student, I had a firm policy to not take any classes before 11 a.m. I would wake up at 10:30, you know, run out to class, you know, 11 o'clock. Yeah. So I thought, to study this Hinduism course from a world-famous professor, I'll make the supreme sacrifice and take an 8 o'clock class, rising at the unheard-of early hour of 7:30 a.m. So I went to the class from the world-famous professor, and he went over the reading of the course and what the course is going to cover, and he gave his first assignment. I want you all to read this section of the Upanishads and then write an essay on what you think it means. So I became angry. I said, wait a minute. I got up at 7:30 in the morning to come to a class at 8 a.m. just to have a professor tell me to speculate. I could do that any time, especially 2 a.m. in the morning. Now I've gotten up this early just to tell for him to tell me to speculate. I said, forget this class. So I decided I'll go to the Yale University bookshop. I'll look for the books for the course that are on the reading list. I'll buy all the books and I'll read them on my own. So on the list was one Bhagavad Gita, apparently, by a British professor, Thomas Edgerton. So I took the books back to my flat and I said, ah, Bhagavad Gita, I've heard so much about it. Let me read this. Now bear in mind that this was in the 70s, during the times when student radicalism was very popular. If you were a student, you were a radical. You were against the government, you were against this, you were against that. I picked up this Bhagavad Gita, and in the front were the verses, in the back was a commentary. I looked at the commentary, and I read a sentence. Krishna is a concept meant to please both the intellectuals and the sentimentalists. I said, what? I just took the book and threw it against the wall. I said, and with my mentality conditioned by student radicalism, I said, how dare this British imperialist colonizer ruin the Indian people's book? I've got to find a real translation of Bhagavad Gita by one of the people, not from this colonizing imperialist. Anyway, through that conditioning, Krishna was saving me from reading Mayavad philosophy. I didn't know anything about Krishna. I just read the sentence. Krishna is a concept meant to please both the sentimentalists and the intellectuals. And I just, does this guy think he is saying something like that? Just threw the book against the wall. That was the last I ever touched it. So I just said, this guy's puffed up. I said, I've got to find a native people's translation of this book. I'm not going to learn Bhagavad Gita from some colonizer, imperialist, fascist. So, as soon as I got Bhagavad Gita as it is, it cost me, $4, Bhagavad Gita as it is, in 1972. 4 years at Yale now costs $100,000. So, that Bhagavad Gita, that cost $4. As soon as I read it, I said, this is the real education I'm looking for, worth far more than the $100,000, just the $4 I spent on this Bhagavad Gita. As it is, giving Krishna's teachings purely. Otherwise, one may be a swami, professor, this, that. But what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita, 4th chapter? Bhakto si me sakha cheti rahasyam hetarutamam. Arjuna, I'm telling you Bhagavad Gita because you're my bhakta, you're my devotee, and my sakha, you're my friend. So you have to hear some You have to hear Bhagavad Gita from someone who is a devotee of Krishna and a friend. You may be a swami, all glories, very nice. You may be a professor, wonderful. You may be British, Indian, American, whatever, from Antarctica. I don't care. You have to be a Krishna Bhakta. You understand? All right, you take Bhagavad Gita in that way. Anything else? All right, I think it's time for some kirtan.
Yeah.
Okay.